You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Spotlight Podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us. My name's Will Gregory, consultant physiotherapist at Salford Royal. I'm delighted that we have this spotlight on pain for this month's resources, but that hopefully this podcast will last longer than that month and go round the world as well as across the UK through rheumatology and beyond. Particularly delighted that we've got our first choice and top speaker, and Nick Schenker is kindly joined us today, consultant rheumatologist in Cambridge, chair of the MSK Pain Specialist Interest Group at the BSR, and chair of the NIHR Expert Panel in Digital Technologies for Pain. So Dr. Schenker, Nick, thank you very much for sparing us some of your time.
Oh, it's an absolute delight, Will, and thank you very much for having me. It's a privilege, and it's a wonderful opportunity just to share some thoughts about pain, really.
And I've been given a list of questions that one of my colleagues and yourself have talked to, and I'm delighted with the first question because it's short, but I think the answer will be less short. The first question we're going to talk to is, what is pain?
Well, I think it's such a crucial thing, really, to actually get across some basic concepts that have helped me in my practice. And I think just make consultations move on much more easily. Pain is a conscious experience, and it is what somebody tells you it is. And you can go deeper into that in quite a number of different levels. But I think that's the overriding concept, because what that does is it validates somebody. So straight away, you're establishing the trust that the patient needs from you. You're not invalidating their experience. Because pain is a sensation and an emotion. It is generated by the brain. It is a conscious experience. I can never feel someone else's conscious experience. Their qualia is theirs, and my qualia is mine. So if they're telling me that they're in pain, if I were to tell them that they're not, then that's a complete nonsensical way of going about things. But then you're entering the land into their world. Is what if you're going to believe everything that they say, then you've then got to form that into something that is useful in the consultation, either diagnostically, therapeutically, prognostically, or just in generating a relationship that will allow you to work within. So what is pain? It is what someone tells you. And it is a sensation, and it is an emotion. And we know that the neuroanatomy of emotional pain is very different to the neuroanatomy of sensory pain. Acute pain tends to be sensory. You can locate it. You can describe it. It's got a character. It's got an onset. It's got an alleviating or an exacerbating factor. So with all the stuff that the mnemonic Socrates, like onset, character, radiation, associated symptoms, time of onset and duration, and it's exacerbating relieving factors and severity. So that's Socrates. And that beautifully describes the sensory component of pain. It describes no emotional component. And given that most of our patients will have emotional pain, chronic pain, pain that goes on for more than 3 months, is usually emotional predominantly. And a number of neuroanatomical studies and neuroimaging studies are there to support that. Then you need to have some framework in which to operate to capture the emotional. And trying to identify when you're in the consultation, someone's sight onset and ending up with not some clarity, almost by definition means that you're dealing with emotional. So if you end up trying to find out where is this pain coming from, when did it start, what makes it worse, and you almost feel that tenseness in the conversation, then switch tack. Go into an emotional fact. Go into the thoughts of, I'm so sorry to hear that. Close the space. Keep the eye contact. Give space. Don't interrupt. Because that'll smooth through the consultation no end. And you've established a relationship, you've got the trust. And don't forget that we need to believe our patients. They need to trust us. They don't need to believe us, and we don't need to trust them. So it's you need to think that through in some ways. But there is a power differential in the relationship, and we need to be looking for different things. So again, what is pain? It's what people say it. It's a sensory experience. It's an emotional experience. It's generated by the brain. I hope that helps.
Yes, and you've veered into some of the issues we're going to discuss later as well on the podcast, I think. I really like what you said about being quite patient-led. So if they don't want to answer your script as such, you need to deviate from that script and ask about the pain in a different way. So are you saying, you know, if they're not answering the study questions, you move into that emotional pain response? Do you then come back to the standard script later? Or if you then deviated towards a different way of trying to interpret their pain and kind of support their storytelling, I guess?
Yes, I think you highlight the narrative needs to be met. People will come to you with an expectation. They don't necessarily vocalize it. And if you ask for it, they might not actually be able to put the finger on what they want. So meeting the narrative is really important. People, I think people can cope with all sorts of things. And sadly, chronic pain of a duration more than 12 months won't go. If you've got pain in your back for 12 months and every day, and it doesn't, your chances of ever getting pain free from your back are very slim. And I think it's helpful to tell people that. Because it sets the expectation. It's a sad thing to have to tell someone, but it meets the narrative and it clarifies things. I mean, some people get given awful diagnoses and they're very distressing, but they do cope with that. Chronic pain is not a nice diagnosis, but is not going to in itself kill someone. It will lead to a very poor quality of life. And our aim in the world of pain is to improve people's quality of life. And you could argue that's the purpose of rheumatologists and their extended community, is to improve quality of life. So I think meeting the narrative by giving people clarity in their diagnosis, their therapy, and their prognosis, and even if that prognosis means that they're going to be living in pain, I find goes down reasonably well by and large and meets the narrative. And setting the expectations, and that expectation might be as simply as my back pain, I thought was going to be cancer, and I'm delighted it's not. And that's a great narrative to meet, and very straightforward to do with simple imaging or even history taking. So you can meet the narrative in different ways, but it is crucial to have the framework of managing someone's chronic pain, to address their sleep, their identity, their functioning, and I would argue their mood, their anxiety and depression, and their body scheme. Now, the body scheme is not something that a lot of people pay much attention about, but certainly with complex regional pain and in other pain conditions. And that extends to rheumatoid arthritis and inflammatory arthritis. Getting people to engage with their body and to recognize when that's difficult is really part of the chronic pain assessment and therefore management. And it's what physiotherapists like yourself and many others are brilliant at. And I'm sure it's one of the reasons why people in chronic pain do really well when they engage with physical.
You've touched on one of the key topics there. Certainly for the rheumatology audiences, we do see chronic pain in tandem with our inflammatory arthritis and our other diagnoses that might be seen in kind of non-pain rheumatology clinics as such, as well as us, you know, working in primary care or community settings, we'll see pain patients that have other diagnoses that run in tandem with that. So that's kind of the initial conversation you might have, and you may have already answered this, but the next question I've got is, how do you assess pain?
So there's lots of ways to assess somebody's pain, from the GP referral letter to questionnaire they've completed in your waiting room. And I get in my clinic the patients to complete a brief pain inventory. So when they come in, they hand over a two-sided A4 page, one with a map of their body, where they've coloured and highlighted and arrowed where their pain is, with usually a little wordy description next to it. And it's captured their severity of pain. It's captured what medications they're on. It's captured how effective those medications are. And then you've got some clarity about where the pain is, how bad it is. And then goes on in eight quick tick boxes to identify its impact. And you can't assess pain without assessing its impact, because that's going to instruct your management. And you obviously use pain as a symptom to guide you on the diagnosis as well. So I've got some clarity before they've even sat down to the severity of pain, where it is, and the impact that it's got. And then I spend the consultation obviously establishing trust, belief, and rapport, but also getting clarity on the diagnosis. And over time, that comes fairly quickly. Once you've seen a few thousand patients and go through it, you can usually pick it out from the GP letter, or at least have a differential. Sometimes it's a little bit harder and you need to examine the patient much more thoroughly. But again, I save time by examining my patients whilst I'm taking this guiding. As you go through the diagnostic modeling of moving away from your algorithmic assessment into a more hypothetical, deductive modeling rationale. I think I've watched myself go through that process, and it happens after, the 6,000 patients. And all of a sudden, you've got your clarity on differential diagnosis and you know what questions to ask. But if you're still algorithmically working, then you can still work through and be thorough, because then you gain the insight and you learn. Occasionally, I am caught out, as everybody is, but that's what safety netting is about. And I think if you've established rapport and trust, the patient will forgive an awful lot. It's then having access after you've completed consultation sort of guides the rest of the service, really. Yes, I've got a clarity on the diagnosis. I've got a clarity on the impact. I've, in my mind's eye, got a clarity on the four pillars of pain management, psychological, and that includes educational and sleep management. It's physical. It is medicines, and it is the educational side of things. So that is so important. It's in there with both the psychological and meeting the narrative, essentially. So once you've got your four pillars in place, and that's what I'm doing whilst I'm assessing someone. And if their diagnosis is one of rheumatoid arthritis, that, to my mind, is a lower node on the hierarchy of management. Because that's very straightforward. Managing rheumatoid arthritis is very straightforward. A bunch of DMARDs. You use steroids to get you out of trouble. You've got your injections. You can refer for surgery. The biological management, the biomedical, management of a sub-diagnosis within the chronic pain sphere is relatively straightforward. And there are some icing on the cake, and you've got expertise within a large department to talk about exactly which biologic agent you might want, or whether which therapeutic trial to put people forward to. But really, the management of chronic pain of rheumatoid arthritis should be within the four pillars of pain management. It's physical therapy, psychological therapy, medications, and meeting the narrative, the education, getting it clear. So that's how I assess pain. And it's just sort of, it's a one-stop shop, really. I'm assessing and managing at the same time. And all of what I've described above, the brief pain inventory captures very quickly. There's a sleep score on there. There's a mood score on there. There's a functioning score on there. So it makes my life a lot easier.
I suspect from my experience, it's quite a nice introductory tool, because this person comes to your clinic and the first thing they receive is this two-page sheet of A4 asking them the kind of questions of information they want to tell you. And you mentioned the validation building relationship, even in giving them that piece of paper. They're like, actually, yeah, this person's going to take me seriously. And they're asking the kind of things that I want to share as part of my pain experience, my pain journey.
Yeah, and I certainly have found over the last few years the struggle that I initially had to establish trust and to get people on board is much quicker. And I don't know whether that's because I'm grayer, or whether people have spoken about me, or whether there seems to be, or maybe I've just got quicker and better at establishing trust and rapport with people. But there is something that is really important in that first 30 seconds of the consultation that sets up the next 20 minutes really importantly, and you can lose people very quickly.
So we're going to switch slightly, although you've already touched on this and you've mentioned the four pillars of kind of pain management, pain treatment. When you think about that, do you have a specific approach as to which pillar you might build first or which pillars your structure relies on? I might be taking the analogy a bit too far here, but...
No, you're absolutely bang on and sort of extending the house, as it were. You've got different rooms you could go and visit for weight management or sleep hygiene or even body scheme engagement, motor imagery work and desensitization and engagement with your own hands and your own feet. So this is the personalized aspect of pain management. And it's actually the joy of clinical medicine is that very rarely will two people have identical pain management plans because everybody's different. And the complexity of pain and its impact on people's lives is such that, they may not be able to walk their Labrador in the same way that somebody who might be able to walk their Chihuahua a little bit easier. So you really got to, and this is the joy of clinical medicine, getting to know people and their lives and the impact that it is. And how do you do that in the sort of 20 minutes or 30 minutes that you've got? You've got to make some shortcuts. And I think you can't progress the consultation unless you've got a clarity on diagnosis. And that's crucial. And once you've got the diagnosis, you're more or less home or dry. You can spend the rest of your time on a management aspect. So, yes, some people, psychological therapies are not the same. Cognitive behavioral therapy works or has the best evidence for most pain conditions, but it doesn't work for complex regional pain, which is much more an angry emotional type pain. And that's what binds much better with mindfulness, relaxation, cognitive analytical therapy, the more detailed back to childhood psychodynamic therapy that can take 16 weeks. Might involve post-traumatic therapies that might bridge into EMDR. So psychological therapies is a bit of a black box for most clinicians, but there's a whole layer, and the emotional well-being services, the increasing access to psychological therapies in the UK are well-resourced and expect to be referred patients who have primary psychological drivers. And when I'm assessing a patient, I'm trying to figure out whether the cart of the body is in front or behind the brain of the horse. Because if somebody's psychologically not there, then you can't rehabilitate them. They can't engage with a physical rehabilitation program. They need to be present and engaged. And so if there is post-trauma, if there is unresolved abuse, if there is ongoing significant stressors, and that might be housing, financial, physical, or emotional, then you've really got to deal with that. Patients know, by and large, and I have frank and open conversations with them. And he said, do you want to go to psychology? Do you think that you can engage with a rehab or should we do this first? Sometimes I've just got to make some. So that's psychological therapies, and they go before physical therapies. You can't put the cart before the horse. but if people want to engage with physical therapies, they're the therapies that will get chronic pain better. When you look at whole treatment effect, 60 to 70% of the whole treatment effect comes from physical therapy in improving people's lives who have chronic pain. 20 to 30% from psychological therapies and 10% from tablets. And tablets are used to get people engaged. Tablets, the medications arm of the therapies, are really hard. The evidence base is shocking. The short-term use is really good, but it is on an N-of-1 basis. I think randomized controlled studies of chronic pain therapies are probably not the right treatment paradigm. And I think the MRC have done good work in putting together complex interventions, and pain is a complex intervention. And we should put the treatment of pain within that MRC framework. And randomized controlled studies are not necessarily the right approach. But any medication comes with side effects, and you've got to weigh that up and counsel the patients. Tricyclics sedate and constipate and dry mouths. Gabapentinoids make you put on weight and make you woozy. SSRIs can blur your thinking as well, blunt emotion, constipate, dry your mouth out. But they all do help in the short term. I think if people have been on something 5 years, you've really got to wonder whether that's doing anything or whether they've just got that psychological crutch. And then the fourth pillar is that narrative that's so important, the education, the guiding people, giving them their expectations or the prognosis, and know you can get better if you engage, you can really lose that weight, you can, or I'm sorry, this probably isn't going to work. You've had this for 5 years now, and the best we can hope for is to keep you as in a reasonable quality of life and maybe employed to some degree.
And those percentages are really interesting with regards to what's going to get your patients better or improve their life despite the pain, I guess. How do you think the 2021 NICE guidance for chronic primary pain has changed what we do, perhaps initially pharmacologically, but also more broadly with that guidance coming through and being, well, just 2 and a bit years old now?
Yeah, I think it was, my hat goes off to the members of that committee. I think they've done an excellent job in really what's a very difficult area. I think they've got the broad thrust of the complexity of pain in there. They certainly have got the importance of relationships and assessing pain and its impact. And I think it's very interesting that you've picked up on the medication aspect of it. I think a lot of people have come to me and actually said that, right, nothing really works for pain and we should stop everything. And that is absolutely not what that guideline says if you actually read it. And if you look at the points, sort of 1.2.6, they do recommend SSRIs. Mm-hmm. And if you look at 2.12, then they do recommend shared care decision-making and engaging with conversations. And I think that's possibly been missed, certainly by managers, particularly pharmacists, perhaps by some primary care physicians. But I think the majority of people who work within chronic pain understand the nuances of that guideline. And they know that if you're trying to wean someone off an addictive medication like gabapentin, you can't just go in and stop it. I think it's really helpful. And I think they did have one eye on the opioid epidemic in America. That fortunately has not really blossomed here in the UK, which is good. And I think a lot of that goes to the work of the pharmacists and the primary care physicians who have picked up patients who are on high doses of opioids and have endeavoured to wean them down. And I think that's absolutely the right approach. Opioids are, they allow people escape. And people on high doses of opioids struggle with the present, and that's usually psychological, an unresolved psychological problem. And adding strong opioids to that mix is just a recipe for disaster. I think a lot of good has come from those guidelines. But I think the take-home message is that you can still use these medications. There is an evidence base, although it's not a strong evidence base. And I think if you recognize that you're only going to get at best 10% of your total improvement, giving medications without the physical rehabilitation, without meeting the narrative, without psychological support, is essentially equivalent to peeing in the breeze, and everybody gets dirty, then you're not going to make any progress. So medications do have their role in chronic pain, but they need to be introduced in with good counsel.
And talking of good counselling, perhaps, with regards to referring into pain services, what advice would you have for our listeners? You know, how should we consider who does or doesn't need that level of support assessment?
So chronic pain is very common. One-fifth of the Western world suffers with it, if you ask them. So obviously pain clinic can't deal with everything. And if you're going to refer everybody who's got chronic pain to pain clinics, then that's going to be not very helpful. So you do have to triage. And broadly speaking, you're not going to cure chronic pain. If the narrative's not met, then try and meet the narrative. If you can't get people accepting of their pain condition, then that might guide a referral. Because pain clinic can offer services that rheumatologists can't. Usually have psychologists attached. They can offer 3 week or 2 week 100-hour programs where they meet people on a daily basis. They can get physical intervention in. Then usually have access to a hydrotherapy pool or some gym that they can use. And they can do things intensely, and they often can give a bit more time than we can in MSK services or rheumatology. So, broadly speaking, are patients coping with their pain or are they not coping? And that's my divider. And I ask them, I think you're coping with pain. Or are you coping with your pain? And if they burst into floods of tears, then I think you've got your answer. And it opens up a different conversation. And so they're the people in chronic pain that I refer to pain services. I think for MSK services, acute sciatica and a clear lesion that needs a nerve block, I certainly refer those through. And pain services, who are usually completely overburdened with 6 to 9 month waits to see new patients, will often eat a new patient slot in for an urgent or epidural or nerve block. So what are the other patients I refer through? I think some people come with expectations as well. And no matter how much I try and assuage, they want to be seen by the pain clinic. And of course, I'll refer them through because that meets the narrative. The final group are those that need another form of intervention, a spinal stimulator or going forward towards amputation, more complex form. Those broad categories. But essentially, it's the question, are they coping? If not coping, pain clinics are very good at getting people to accept and cope.
And I think that's really nice. I quite like the phrase you've had of meeting the patient's narrative that you've mentioned a few times in this podcast. And as a hope to try and bring us towards the end of our time together, I'm going to try and meet the narrative of the podcast structure, which is our final question, which is usually to ask our expert guest about anything they've got with regards to guidelines, articles, courses they'd recommend, and kind of any top tips for managing their pain patients. And apologies, we could talk for hours about this, but the nature of making this punchy is we want a nice, easy to access podcast for our listeners. So.
Yes. So, I mean, Anushka Soni's just put a very nice article into the British Medical Journal about how to assess and manage chronic pain. You can't go wrong by reading the NICE guidelines. You can't go wrong by reading the EULAR recommendations for fibromyalgia. You are going to find, if you're particularly interested in research about this, anything that Neil Basu in Glasgow has published on neuroimaging. In the Oxford group have published lots on pain. There are many other pain groups working on this. Top tips, well, courses and things. I think if you're particularly interested in pain, the European Federation run very nice conferences, EFIC, E-F-I-C. If you're interested in a website, the International Association for the Study of Pain, IASP, has a fabulous website, and so does EFIC. On pain. The Chronic Pain Coalition have websites. Complex Regional Pain Syndrome UK have a website, CRPS UK. Fibromyalgia UK have a website. Don't forget the Centre for Pain, funded by the Versus Arthritis and led by David Walsh in Nottingham, has a great repository. And I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed and learned a lot from reading Gerald Edelman, E-D-E-L-M-A-N, and his pop science books on consciousness. There's lots out there. You just need to find one good one and spend a bit of time to really get your head around it. For all BSR members, come to the Pain SIG. We've got a very active SIG. We've got podcasts that are available, and we've done other initiatives. We would love to put some more guidelines together about how to manage pain for the inflammatory arthritis and chronic pain. And top tips. Yes, well, hopefully we've covered a few of them. And establishing the relationship, patient's always right. Pain is in the head because it's generated by the brain, conscious experience. You want to be patient-led on the management so that if they don't want the tablets, don't force it on them. If they think they've done enough, then I wouldn't push it. You want to move people into accepting and coping. And if that is not what you might expect, then I wouldn't necessarily treat the target. Now, a couple of other tips, really. I don't think we fully understand pain. And I think understanding how the body scheme interacts with pain has been a real help to me in clinic. Thinking about body scheme and its impact on pain, I think when you're stuck, it can get you out of difficulties. But no, my last tip is to enjoy it. I mean, these people, one of the advantages of knowing that you can't experience someone else's pain is that you don't have to get involved in that. That's their experience. And you can be separate to it. So I hope that's helpful. I've absolutely enjoyed this podcast.
And we can hear your enthusiasm and enjoyment of this area of rheumatology, of MSK work. And I think that's quite infectious. So really grateful that you've shared your expertise, enthusiasm and enjoyment with the three E's, if we're going to call it that, on this podcast. So just remains for me to say thanks very much for your time in preparing and kind of delivering such a great podcast for us, Nick.
Thank you, Will, and thanks to the team for inviting me. And thanks to listeners. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Please do get in touch with us at the BSR podcast team or with Nick direct if you want. There's other really useful resources this month as we focus on pain, but also lots to see from the other recommendations that Nick just gave us. And we will put a list of those references on the website for you. So signing off for this podcast, thanks so much for your attention. And we look forward to dropping into your podcast feed again in the near future. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology Spotlight, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.